Good morning, brothers and sisters and young people. In our last class this morning, brothers and sisters, we're going to try and apply tips and tools for Bible study, those which we have covered, perhaps repeated several times over the first three sessions, to the subject of Bible prophecy. We've deliberately chosen Bible prophecy as the subject of application, because Bible prophecy is an area which, in the last few years in our community, has been opened up to quite a number of divergent points of view. And I'm sure there are many members in our community that at one time perhaps were fairly firmly fixed in their approach to some of these prophetic subjects, but of recent have felt rather unsettled and unsure, and have wondered who is right, and have wondered how do I come about to determine in my own mind satisfactorily what is the most correct or the most likely interpretation. It's also important because in suggesting divergent points of view on prophecy in the last few years, some brethren have urged that their approach is particularly biblical in their approach, as if to suggest, it would seem to me, that former approaches, or perhaps Brother Thomas's approach, was not so biblically based. I believe, brothers and sisters, we ought to satisfy our own minds on that subject. If we're just new in the truth, it's perhaps not the first subject that we would engage our study in. But I do believe that sooner or later, we've got to come to grips with that subject. Even if we're never totally satisfied, and even if we never feel that we've answered all the questions that might arise, at least to proceed through some exercise of Bible study ourselves in the area of prophecy, especially in the difficult books like Daniel and Revelation. It doesn't mean, as I've said, that you will be satisfied necessarily as to what all the answers are, but the exercise is spiritually uplifting. It should convince you of the internal harmony of the Scriptures, and that in itself is exhortational. And it should also convince you that in order to come to a satisfactory conclusion about the various individuals that are mentioned in the apocalypse of the New Testament, you've got to have some Old Testament basis. And if we're convinced that we can simply begin the subject of prophetic interpretation in Revelation by starting there, rather than first starting in the Old Testament, we're going to be very much disappointed. May I just recall what we said in one of our earlier studies? New Testament Christianity, as one brother has expressed it, is a religion of ignorance. That was never so true than in the subject of Bible interpretation of prophecy. There is a very definite need to start in the Old Testament. The book of Daniel provides some of the master keys for understanding the apocalyptic visions given to John in Revelation. But other books have to be given some attention. Zechariah has some very critical passages which have a bearing on the interpretation of the Revelation. There are passages in Isaiah and in Ezekiel, likewise, that have to be considered. Now, looking at this array of prophetic visions in Daniel, Zechariah, and Revelation, one is very easily discouraged. One of the perhaps more attractive features of recent approaches in the community has been the suggestion that we don't need to turn to history, we don't need to have any understanding of the rise and fall of the Roman Empire, let's say by Gibbon. We don't need to delve into all these extra history books, we just need our Bibles. Well, brothers and sisters, I'm sure some people have been attracted by that approach and felt that it was a satisfactory one, and have never felt satisfied anyways about looking in history books, and thus have perhaps felt that some of the more recent approaches are more biblical and perhaps have a little more merit. What we'd like to explore in this class, simply for the purposes of applying some tips and tools for Bible study, is to demonstrate that we don't need to start with history books by any means to fathom some of these more difficult passages in the apocalyptic visions, both Old and New Testament. We can start for sure on a very biblical ground, and we don't need to turn to any extra books. And yet, I believe, we will come to conclusions that point very much in the same direction as that was which was suggested by Brother Thomas. Speaking on my own behalf, although I have a particular love for history and history books myself, I was never so convinced how much possible it is to come through this subject on a strictly biblical approach than when I finally sat down and forced myself to use my Bible margins, to use the Old Testament, and to follow the clues through and let the Old Testament help me interpret the New. And having done that, without any recourse to history books, I became quite convinced that the basic approach that was taken by Brother Thomas is the right one. My objective here is, first and foremost, then, not to suggest which interpretation is the correct one in this area of Bible interpretation, but to show you how, without a great knowledge of history and so on, a very biblical approach can be taken, and using tips and tools for Bible study, I think you'll find the study more rewarding and more exciting. Where do we start in this area? Do we start in Revelation? I've suggested that's not the place to start. Old Testament, for sure, is the starting point. But I'd like to suggest this morning that there's a passage in the New Testament, not in Revelation, that provides an important bridge and kind of a staging ground for launching forward into an interpretation of these difficult sections. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, which Gil read for us, is, I believe, a kind of New Testament bridge into this difficult subject. I say it's a bridge because it throws links back into the Old Testament, which we've got to follow up first. But there are certain directions that 2 Thessalonians 2 gives to us as we go back into the Old Testament. It will direct our course instead of just plunging anywhere. Do we start in Daniel? Do we start in Ezekiel? Do we start in Zechariah? I believe 2 Thessalonians 2 provides some direction for that. And then secondly, 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 throws roots into Revelation. And if we follow the directions, I believe, that are given in this prophecy of 2 Thessalonians 2, it'll give us some help as to where we should start in the Old Testament, and that in turn will help guide us into the links that this prophecy makes in Revelation. So in that sense, it's a kind of staging ground, the place to start from. And let's take a look at it together. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. Let's say we know very little about this subject. We see this as an important prophecy. It's raised by almost all brethren who touch on the subject of apocalyptic visions in Daniel and the ones in Revelation. Recent interpretations in the community have at least agreed on one point, and that is that 2 Thessalonians 2 is certainly related in some way to the systems described in Revelation and to the beast figures that are described in Daniel. They seem to be all agreed on that. And of course, I believe that is right. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, let's look at some of the details and see where we can get some Old Testament help. I believe the first place to look is 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 3 and 4. Let no man deceive you, writes Paul, by any means, for that day shall not come except there come a falling away first, and that man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition, who opposeth and exalteth himself above all that is called God or that is worshipped, so that he, as God, sitteth in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. Now, as we showed in one of the earlier classes, when we were dealing with this for a different purpose, your Bible margin around the area of verse 4 should direct you to a number of Old Testament links. We noticed on the overhead yesterday that the Revised Version directs us to several passages from verse 4 and 3 that lead into Daniel 7, as you can see here, Daniel 8. We're told that perhaps we should look at Daniel 11, verse 36, and of course it directs us into Revelation. And then in the section in verse 4 of 2 Thessalonians 2, setting himself forth as he is God, We're told that we should look at Isaiah 14 and Ezekiel 28. Now, as we go down through our Bible margin in 2 Thessalonians 2, we will also notice, I'm going to draw your attention to these, that Daniel is mentioned more than once later on with connections. Up here, you can see where my finger is pointing. There's a link with Revelation 17 in a section dealing with the beast prophecies. Down below here, there's a link with Revelation 13, also dealing with the beast prophecies. Down at the bottom of the margin, the very bottom, there's another suggestion that we turn again to Revelation 17. Now see, just as an overview, what this is at least suggesting. The man of sin prophecy has links with Daniel 7, Daniel 11, both dealing with prophecies that have links with Revelation. The four beasts which Daniel saw coming out of the sea, in particular the fourth beast that had 10 horns, and then one horn, if you remember, came up that then devoured and plucked up three of the other horns. We don't know what that is, perhaps, but there's a link, it seems, with that prophecy. Daniel 11 talks about the king of fierce countenance, who will exalt himself and magnify himself. So we have links there. We have links with Isaiah 14, the Lucifer passage of Babylon, and Ezekiel 28, the link with Tyre. But we also, as we scan down through our marginal reference here, have links with Revelation 13, a beast prophecy, and we have links with Revelation 17, dealing with the beast and the whore that rides on the beast. So this at least convinces us of one thing. Whoever this man of sin is, whatever he represents, he is, in a certain sense, a direct link with the Old Testament, and he's a link with Revelation. He is linked with the beast system in Revelation, Revelation 13 and 17, and he's somehow linked in with the very same kind of beast system visions in Daniel. Now, so far, we haven't turned to any history. All we're seeing is a general overview here. The man of sin is linked with those systems in Daniel dealing with the beasts, and he's linked with these beast systems and the whore in Revelation. That's why, in passing, all our recent interpretations of Revelation have at least agreed, as I've said, on one point. These brethren have in their books all agreed that this man of sin definitely has a link with their interpretations of Daniel, and he has an important link with their interpretations of Revelation. Now, this is why 2 Thessalonians 2 is a good starting point. If the recent interpretations identify the man of sin with the links in Daniel and the links in Revelation, and if 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 is the easiest area to start with, and if it can give us some direction before we go into the Old Testament or before we go into Revelation, then we are working in an area that should help us evaluate the interpretations that have been fairly recent. If they are wrong in their interpretation of the man of sin, it will affect their conclusions about Daniel, and it will affect their conclusions about Revelation. And of course, the converse is true. If their identity of the man of sin is correct, then it will certainly give greater credence to their identification of the similar system in Daniel and the similar system in Revelation. Now, I personally would contend that 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 is the easiest to work with, rather than trying to start in the visions of Daniel and Revelation. If we can sort out the identity of this man of sin, knowing that he has links with Daniel and that he has links with Revelation in pertinent areas of interpretation, then if we can get straight who he is or what he represents, we can then go into Daniel and have a better idea as to what that system is. Then from there, we can go into Revelation and we'll have a more sure foundation, having come from 2 Thessalonians 2 and having come from Daniel. So it's kind of the meat between the sandwich, as it were, sandwich between Daniel and Revelation. If we can identify this, we have some important clues. If recent interpreters are wrong on the man of sin prophecy, it will definitely have a domino effect on their approach to Daniel and their approach to Revelation in those areas that are bound up with this man of sin prophecy. So that's the kind of rationale that we're working with. I was always perplexed myself as to where to start in this array of prophecy. And that was an indebtedness I'd have to express to a brother back in Canada who suggested to me, start with 2 Thessalonians 2. That's the least symbolic of all the prophecies. It's not as difficult to interpret the timing in 2 Thessalonians 2 as it is in Revelation and Daniel. Get the identity straight, find out what the timing is, and then note the links with the Old Testament and Revelation. I found that to be one of the wisest and one of the most satisfying approaches to this difficult subject. And all along the path, I was impressed with the value of using my Bible margin, going back and asking, what does this remind me of? Checking out the Old Testament context, and also, of course, using a piece of paper and a pencil sometimes to write down what was the structure of the argument. I'm deliberately returning to tips and points that we've mentioned earlier this weekend. Well, let's start in a simple way with 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. We'll come back to the importance of these links in the Old Testament in just a moment. As you're taking a look at a chapter like 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, I think the wisest thing to do, first of all, is get the flow of the argument. Who is this man? Is he essentially a political figure? Is he a religious figure? Is he standing for himself, or does he represent a system? How do we know? Well, the structure of the argument. Take a piece of paper and scratch down what you think are the identifying features of the man of sin. What are the characteristics of this man? So you write down, let's say, 20 characteristics listed by Paul. Then you stand back and you look at these characteristics and you say, well, now, can I organize them around certain headings? And it's possible to do that. Here's the attempt by one brother that I found particularly helpful. He noted about 21 identifying features, and the process was to write them down first. It's an apostate system. How do we know it's apostate? Well, 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 3. Let no man deceive you by any means, for that day shall not come except there come a falling away first. And you might say, well, what are the key words here? A falling away? Is that apostasy? It might be. It sounds like apostasy. So you check your Young's Concordance, right? You check your concordance, let's say, with Strong's, and you look up the word falling away, and you discover, not that it's just a guess that it might be apostasy, but you discover in Young's Concordance, or in Strong's, for example, that the words falling away are in fact only one word in the original, and it's the Greek word apostasia, from which we get the word apostasy. So we're not second guessing when we say that the man of sin is linked with apostasy. It's the very Greek word in the original from which our English word comes. That's one of the few places in the New Testament where the word apostasy occurs. So there's no doubt about that. That's a very direct statement. We note that he's lawless and he's sinful from verse 3. We note that he existed in the first century. Key point. Let's notice that. Chapter 2, verse 7. The mystery of iniquity doth already work. Only he who now letteth will let, until he be taken out of the way. So let's say you're reading verse 7, brothers and sisters, and you say, well, it's a mystery. It's a mystery of iniquity. It doth already work. Must note that. So you put down on a piece of paper, already at work in the first century. You make that a note to yourself in your little pencil listing. Then you come across the second part of verse 7, and perhaps you're perplexed. What does this mean, only he who now letteth will let, until he be taken out of the way? You don't understand what that phrasing means. It's not too clear. So what do you do? You turn to, let's say, the Revised Standard Version. Or you might turn, for example, to the New American Standard. Any modern translation. See if you can get a better feeling for what that's saying. You discover, by going to a more modern translation, or by checking it out in the concordance, that this term, who now letteth, actually means to bind. He who now is binding or holding down will continue to hold down until he's taken out of the way. You might say, well, I don't understand who that is. But perhaps now, from a modern translation, you at least get the sense. The mystery of iniquity is already working now in the first century. So whoever the man of sin is, the system that he's related to, or the power or the values that he represents, are rooted in the first century. Now you know that. You know also that it's an apostate figure. You know that it's lawless. You know from verse 6 that for some reason, in some way, this man of sin, power, was being held down. It was being restrained for a period. And you've seen that from the modern translations, or you've checked out the word letteth in the concordance. Verse 8, you've noted, and then shall that wicked be revealed. And we might say, oh, when will that be? Whom the Lord shall consume with the spirit of his mouth, and shall destroy with the brightness of his coming. We don't know exactly how long after the restraining influence has been removed in verse 7. We don't know how long after that has been taken out as a restraining influence that it will be before the wicked system is revealed. We don't know what the timing is. First, it will be restrained for a while, but it's already present in the first century. It's being held down. Somehow, the restraining influence will be removed, and then shall that wicked be revealed, whom the Lord shall consume with the spirit of his mouth. Now we have a second very important point in terms of timing. Not only do we know that he was present in the first century, although he was restrained, verse 8 tells us that he would be later revealed. Not only that, but we're told, I'm going down here, that he would be destroyed by Christ in the end. Now that's interesting. Here's a man of sin, whoever he is, present in the first century, howbeit held down, restrained, kept under, but still it was working. Like leaven. Here's a system that would be destroyed by Christ when Christ returns. Is this a system that would simply arise in the last few years before Armageddon with no previous and obvious roots in the first century? No. This is a system that was present, howbeit restrained, in the first century, would later be revealed, and then finally it would be destroyed by Christ when he returns. The key word is continuous. We're looking at a continuous system that would have a period of infancy. It wouldn't be too obvious who this system would be. Present in the first century, but not obvious. A restraining influence would finally be lifted, and then shall that wicked be revealed. By the way, what's the word for revealed in the original? We take Young's Concordance because it's a key word, and we look up the word revealed, and lo and behold, we discover it's the word apocalypsed. Well, isn't that a surprise? Then shall that wicked be apocalypsed. Same Greek word for the apocalypse in Revelation, the apocalypse of John. Is there a link with the man of sin and the apocalypse? Certainly there's a possibility. This man of sin has an apocalypse. He is revealed at a certain time. He is present in the first century, and he will be there continuously in some form in order to be destroyed by Christ when he returns. In contrast to recent evangelical interpretations, such as Hal Lindsey's and other fairly prominent evangelical interpreters who take the man of sin prophecy and apply it to only the last 7 years of the earth's existence before Armageddon, who suggest that the man of sin will be a European dictator, an antichrist figure, who will arise in the last 6 or 7 years of the Earth's existence, to arise in those last years to oppose Christ. In contrast to that notion, we are looking for a system that began in the first century and has a continuity that runs through the centuries so that he's present for Christ to destroy him. He's not a pop-up figure that suddenly appears in the last few years of the Earth's existence. The language of the man of sin prophecy is stressing continuity and a long period of existence. Now, brothers and sisters, we continue with some of the other identifying features. He is described by the term lawless. He opposes God. He exalts himself. He has a seat of authority. He has a place in which he describes as the temple of God. He is so audacious as to claim himself to be God in verse 4. His work and activity is characteristically satanic activity. He has power. He has pretentious signs. He works with wonders, and he convinces people to believe in lies, like the serpent in Genesis. He has pleasure in unrighteousness, and so do his followers. And those who follow him have a strong delusion from God. He could be termed the son of perdition, because that will be his demise. He will be destroyed by Christ, and so will his followers. So we list those 20 details on a piece of paper. We go over and over the verses looking for identifying clues, and you jot them down in pencil. And then you stand back and you say, all right, I've got these 20 or 21 identifying features. Can I organize them into headings? It's like doing a school essay. You know how the teacher used to say, first, son, get all your facts, write all your facts down, then organize it in paragraphs. Perhaps we can recall the teacher telling us that. We write down all the identifying features from 2 Thessalonians 2, and then we look for ways in which we can organize those facts under certain headings. And that's the next stage that's been done here on the overhead. The brother who did this used the term movement. Now, you might have not used that term. He can see that there are certain descriptions, numbers 1 to 5 on the overhead, that speak for a movement, meaning it's not just a man. It's focalized in a man called the man of sin, but there's a movement. It's bigger than just a man. How so? Well, it's apostate, it's lawless, it existed in the first century, it was restrained, it was later to be revealed, and if it's present when Christ returns, it's more than just one man, because a man only lives 70 or 80 years. This man of sin obviously represents a movement, because one man doesn't just live for 2,000 years. If it lasts during that long period of time, it is a movement, and not just one man. That should change our approach in trying to identify the man of sin. Are we looking just for a man, or is he described as a man symbolically because he represents something that is very fleshly, something that is man-like rather than God-like? We could reach those conclusions, I believe, quite fairly once we determine that it is a movement and not just a man. That takes us away from Hal Lindsey's approach and some of the popular evangelical approaches to 2 Thessalonians 2. They look for a man, one individual, a European dictator who supposedly will arise in the last 7 years of the earth's existence. He's missed the identifying clues. It's much greater than a man. There's more, though. It is, however, focalized in a man. This man is lawless. He opposes. He exalts himself in an arrogant way. Interestingly, he claims to have some seat of authority. He claims to be sitting in a place that's termed the temple of God by Paul. And he proclaims himself to be God. Again, what system or what man, what power, what movement has characterized itself in that way, has its roots, in fact, boasts of having its roots in the first century, and claims by its own public proclamation to have a continuity down through the centuries through an unbroken line with the apostles, and certainly will be present when Christ returns. We go further. This man achieves a conversion by certain methods. We look for this title, which the brother has suggested, converts. Seduced by, now you might have used different terms, brings people under the influence of by these methods. It just helps to be as an organizer. All right. He is characterized as having satanic activity to bring in his converts. Power, emphasis on signs, wonders, and beliefs of lies. Characteristically, this man of sin system or movement is interested in evangelizing in some way. It's a system, however, that evangelizes not by an appeal to truth, but by an appeal to lies. Its credentials are on the basis of signs and wonders and miracles. The people who are finally brought under this influence are described as being under strong delusion, and they have pleasure in what they're doing. Finally, the demise of this individual and the movement that he forms is described as the son of perdition, because perdition will be his end. It will be destroyed by Christ, and its followers will be condemned. Now we stop. Having organized, perhaps, our list of identifying features, we now look at 2 Thessalonians 2 with some organizing principles. Now, so far, we haven't followed through our marginal references. We haven't gone into the Old Testament. We've just tried to get a handle on this man of sin. And we might ask ourselves, before we even go into the Old Testament, what could be the possible application, before I even look at the Old Testament? A system with these characteristics, a movement that is apostate, is it a political system, essentially? Couldn't be, could it? It may have political elements in it. It may use political force. But what's the emphasis in 2 Thessalonians 2? Political or religious? Religious. In other words, the term apostate is bringing out that stress. So it's not to deny that there may be political elements in this man or in this system, but characteristically it is an apostate system. A system that existed in the first century and has continuity down through the years so that it can be destroyed by Christ when he returns. A system that has a seat of authority, and the man who is the head or the key focus of this system claims himself to be God. Some brethren in the recent interpretations have suggested that the man of sin is essentially a political figure. How can that be said when we look at the fact that it's described as apostate? Well, the suggestion by one brother is that it is not an apostate system for the following reason, and I'll just share this with you, and we'll evaluate it together. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 3. One brother suggests that this is how we should read verse 3. Let no man deceive you by any means, for that day shall not come except there come a falling away first. The brother acknowledges that falling away means apostasy. He suggests that what 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 is telling us, that first there must be an apostasy. But the man of sin is not the apostasy. The brother suggests that when we then follow from the word and, that we're talking about an unrelated system. The man of sin on the right side of the word and is apparently not the same as this apostate falling away. He's not to be identified with it. So the brother suggests that what we're to read here is, Paul says, first there'll be an apostasy, then there'll be the man of sin. And he cuts off that word apostasy and doesn't attach it to the man of sin. He sees the word and as a very formal break, as being a watershed between two systems or two individuals or two stages. Will that hold up? Let's just take a look at the second half of this description in verse 3. Let's say we agree temporarily, for argument's sake, that we cut away the word apostasy and just stay on the right-hand side of that word and that man of sin be apocalypsed, the son of perdition. Could we be right in concluding that the man of sin, the son of perdition, is a biblical description of a political system left to itself without attaching the word apostasy? There is still an identifying feature at the end of verse 3 that makes the man of sin religious in its attachments. How so? with that term, son of perdition. Use your Bible margin. Where else in the Bible does the term son of perdition occur? Use your concordance. Your margin will direct you to John 17 and verse 12. Who's that talking about? Who is the son of perdition in John 17? Judas. A political figure? No, sir. One who was part of the fold. One who was an integral member of the 12. One who betrayed the master with a kiss. One who was part of the community but went out from the community. One who for 3 years was part of the sheepfold. And who finally showed his hand in the last hour and came out. Any other place in the Bible where son of perdition occurs? No. The only place in the New Testament, apart from 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, where the term son of perdition is used, is in John 17. It's of Judas, a member of the Christian community, and a member who was part of that group and who betrayed it by leaving. Thus, by leaving and turning his course, Judas was an apostate, was he not? Isn't that what apostasy means? Doesn't that come out in the King James of verse 3? Instead of using the word apostasy, the King James says, the word means falling away. Wasn't Judas one who fell away? He was. Is the term son of perdition to be separated from the term apostasy? No. 2 Thessalonians 2 introduces the term apostasy on the left-hand side of that word and, without the intention of separating it from the man of sin. How do we know that? Because the man of sin is the son of perdition, and that means he is apostate. And that means he is a Judas of some sort. So son of perdition shows us that it's not correct to separate the idea of apostasy from the man of sin, because the man of sin is later described in this chapter as an apostate figure by the term son of perdition. Where else in the New Testament does the word perdition occur? That might be worth exploring. Where else does the term perdition occur? And we discover it's in Revelation, and we discover it's in the midst of the descriptions in Revelation of the beast system. Lo and behold, isn't that an appropriate context? Considering the pointers that we've looked at so far in 2 Thessalonians 2 and noted that the margin has directed us as having links with the beast systems in Daniel and the beast systems in Revelation. Now there's another link with the beast systems. That term perdition automatically should bring to our attention the beast systems in Revelation now from another slant. Well, brothers and sisters, we still haven't got out of 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. I haven't time to go down through every single turn now, the key features, but perhaps you can get a feeling for the direction we're going in. And hopefully, perhaps for the first time, you've seen the value of starting in this chapter rather than some other spot of Scripture. It's the less complicated. It's the least symbolic. It's a valid place because the wording directs us into those important sections in Daniel, and the wording directs us into Revelation in the relevant sections that we're concerned about. So it's not that we're diving into 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 and suggesting that this has a link with these passages in Daniel when there is no link. It's not that we're using 2 Thessalonians 2 as a kind of key to unlock the prophecies in Revelation dealing with the beasts and the whore, when in fact the man of sin prophecy may not have any connection with them. The language and the allusions in this very chapter direct us to Daniel and Revelation. And then finally, by working out the identifying characteristics of this man and the system he represents, considering its links with Daniel and its links with Revelation, we now have a good lead as to what these systems or symbols represent, possibly in Daniel as well as Revelation. Let's look closely now, once again, at the links with the Old Testament. Here I have on the overhead a blow-up of one small section in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 3 and 4, highlighting some of the key descriptions. Man of sin, son of perdition, falling away. Opposeth and exalteth himself above all that is called God or that is worshipped, so that he is as God, sitteth in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. And we look at our Bible margins, as we have again before. And this overhead is showing you in the RV what passages we should be perhaps looking at, stemming out of verse 4 and verse 3. Now there's Daniel 7, Daniel 11, Daniel 8, and we can see there's Isaiah 14 and there's Ezekiel 28. Now let's look at some of those passages in the Old Testament. Let's look at some of them and see why the Bible margin might be directing us to those passages. We'll start, first of all, with Ezekiel 28, prophecy concerning Tyre. Ezekiel 28, verses 1 and 2. Quickly, we'll look at the prophecy and the key terms, and now we'll see the value, I hope, of using a margin to interpret prophecy, or help us, rather, in our interpretation of prophecy by following the Old Testament links. I've got this on the overhead, the key terms. The word of the Lord came unto me, saying, Son of man, say unto the prince of Tyrus, Thus saith the Lord God, because thine heart is lifted up, and thou hast said, I am a god, I sit in the seat of God, in the midst of the seas, yet thou art a man, and not God, though thou set thine heart as the heart of God. Now you can see perhaps more clearly why the margin has directed you to Ezekiel 28. Notice the links. I am God. That was the posture of the king of Tyre. The man of sin, he opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God, so that he as God, he thinks he's God, showing himself that he is God. The prince of Tyre, I am God. The prince of Tyre sat on a special seat of authority where he made these claims. I sit in the seat of God in the midst of the seas. Again, the link with verse 4 of 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. What is said there? Well, so that he as God, like Tyre, sitteth in the temple of God. So again, another link with the prince of Tyre. Yet, he says, thou art a man. Who is this system in 2 Thessalonians 2? How is it summarized? It's the man of sin. Emphasis on the man. That's interesting. There's three links. The prince of Tyre was arrogant. He arrogated to himself authority that he should never have arrogated. He was blasphemous. Certainly there were political elements involved in the prince of Tyre. Yes, he had political elements. But he spoke in a blasphemous way. Especially he arrogated himself certain authority and terms he should never have. He identified himself with God, which he shouldn't have. He had a temple, he had a seat of authority, and yet he was only a man. Well, there's link number one. We're told that we should look at Isaiah 14 with Lucifer. Here on the overhead, I'll have this for you as well. Let's go there very quickly. I'm only going to have time to raise these passages, and you can draw some of your own conclusions. We're not so much concerned about the interpretive conclusions as we are about seeing how following through into the Old Testament provides satisfying help as a Bible tip or tool for the interpretation of prophecy. So here we are in Isaiah 14. Perhaps we think this is an unlikely context to look in terms of identifying the man of sin. But just look at why the margin has made this link. How art thou fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning? How art thou cut down to the ground, which did weaken the nations? For thou hast said in thine heart, just like the prince of Tyre, and just like the man of sin, I will ascend into heaven, I will exalt my throne. Ah, he's got a throne. The man of sin has a seat. He sits in a temple. The prince of Tyre had a seat, and he sat, proclaiming himself to be God. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will sit, key point again, in its parallel with Thessalonians. I will sit also upon the mount of the congregation in the sides of the north. Also, verse 14, I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 says that the man of sin will sit as though he's God. Same thing is said of Tyre. Same thing is said now of Lucifer. One represents Babylon, one represents Tyre. And as we go into Revelation 17 and Revelation 18 and use Arthur Gibson's list of 701 quotations as a guide, what do we find when we go down through Revelation 17 and 18? Babylon, 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 Tyre, Tyre, Tyre. Old Testament passages being brought to our focus from prophecies concerning Tyre, prophecies concerning Babylon. So in Revelation 17 and 18, dealing with the whore and the beast system, Tyre and Babylon are key connections. When we look at the man of sin prophecy, prophecies concerning Tyre and Babylon are key connections. There again is another link with the man of sin and Revelation. Whatever you make of the man of sin, those beast systems and that harlot is somehow linked. They're being drawn and described from the same Old Testament sources. And there's a strong scriptural foundation for insisting on it. Well, we're told by the Bible margin that there are several other links that we should explore. I'll have to do this rather quickly. Daniel chapter 11. Now this one is very easy to see when you line it up like this on the overhead with Thessalonians. Daniel 11 verse 36, with the king of fierce countenance. Remember how we said in one of our earlier classes yesterday afternoon that Jesus Christ in the Olivet Prophecy quotes this very section concerning the abomination that maketh desolate. And from a harmony of Matthew, Mark, and Luke, we can see that in the Olivet Prophecy, Jesus says this points to Rome, the armies that encircle Jerusalem. In Luke, in the Olivet Prophecy, that make Jerusalem desolate are parallel with the same place in Mark and Matthew that quote Daniel concerning the abomination that make desolate. And if Mark and Matthew are plugging into this section, and Luke describes it as the desolator of Rome, it's no great wonder, is it, that the man of sin prophecy should also draw its allusions from a section that the master used in the Olivet Prophecy and tied in with Rome? We haven't yet gone to a history book, have we? We haven't turned to an atlas. All we're doing is looking at the clues that the master gives in the Olivet Prophecy. What he says Daniel 11 is talking about, and the fact that the man of sin prophecy plugs in to the same section of Daniel 11 and applies it to the man of sin. Is the man of sin linked with Rome? It's very likely, isn't it? Jesus himself has quoted from the same section and applied it to Rome. If Jesus is our interpreter, brothers and sisters, then we have a very biblical approach to a conclusion that was reached many years ago by our founding brethren. And we haven't yet turned to a book of history. What have we done? We've used our Bible margin. We've used clues from the Master's own quotations in the Olivet Prophecy. And we haven't yet gone outside the text of Scripture. Well, why does 2 Thessalonians 2 make the link with Daniel 11? And the king shall do according to his will. Daniel 11, verse 36. And he shall exalt himself and magnify himself above every god, and shall speak marvelous things against the God of gods. Blasphemy. Arrogance. Someone who poses as God himself. See how the king of fierce countenance is like Lucifer from Babylon. He's like the prince of Tyre from Ezekiel 28, and he's like the man of sin. And you can see why the Bible made this link in the margin. Verse 4 of 2 Thessalonians 2 reads, who opposeth, opposeth. King of fierce countenance will say these things against the God of gods. So he'll oppose him. Man of sin, he will exalt himself above all that is called God or that is worshipped. And this one will magnify, same word, exalt himself above every god. So no wonder your Bible margin has made those links. If you go to Daniel chapter 11 in the King James Oxford at verse 36 and look at your margin, you'll see that the Oxford margin at Daniel 11 and 36 does refer to 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 in the margin, and also tells you to take a look at Daniel 7, the fourth beast prophecy. Now our time is gone, brothers and sisters. We could spend really a whole study day on this section alone and work through some rather, I think, important conclusions in terms of prophecy. But for our purpose, let's just use this as an overview in conclusion. The man of sin prophecy, using very basic tips and tools for Bible study. We started in 2 Thessalonians 2. We found the structure and the flow of the argument. We listed the characteristics and we made a note of the timing. Present in the first century, present when Christ returns. We then use our margin to follow back to the Old Testament roots. It took us back to Isaiah 14. Two key phrases linked with 2 Thessalonians 2. It took us into Ezekiel 28, prophecy from Tyre, with a key phrase that ties in with 2 Thessalonians 2. Your margin at Daniel 11 throws back to 2 Thessalonians 2, and the margin at Daniel 11 also connects with Daniel 7 and says we should look there. We didn't look at it on the overhead, but Daniel 7 has a similar description of these other ones. The little horn that comes out of the fourth beast. A little horn that comes out of a fourth beast, and he's described in Daniel 7 as a man. He has the mouth of a man, Daniel is told, and he has the eyes of a man. And he's a very arrogant figure, like Ezekiel, like Lucifer, like the man of sin, with the stress on him being a man. A man, a horn that has the mouth of a man and eyes of a man. And he speaks arrogant things. And he speaks against the Most High. Daniel 11, we've been there. The last link, which we haven't yet time really to explore, is a very important link with Zechariah 5. And there's a little change in Zechariah 5. There are four Greek words in Zechariah 5 in the Septuagint, the Greek edition of Zechariah 5. Four key Greek words that are used by Paul in his description of the man of sin. And some Bible margins have picked up that link. The AV, King James Oxford, does not. We haven't time to explore that. Except to note, man, Isaiah. Man, Ezekiel 28. A man in Daniel 7. A man in Daniel 11, and the link with Zechariah provides a woman figure. Now that's interesting. A woman in an ephah, a measuring container, a lid that held her down and contained her, and in that container, that woman in the ephah was lifted up by two unclean birds, like storks, and it says in Zechariah chapter 5, she was picked up and taken off to Shinar. Shinar. What's that? Babylon. But in Zechariah, Babylon has already been destroyed. That is Babylon literal. When Zechariah's prophecy is given, the Jews have returned from Babylon because Medo-Persia has destroyed Babylon. So how could this woman in a container be taken to Shinar, that is, to literal Babylon, when Babylon's already been destroyed by Medo-Persia?